Welcome to the Who's Left podcast, a show about Indiana politics, history, and culture from the unapologetic perspective of the Hoosier left. My name is Scott Aaron Rogers, and I'm recording from Bloomington. This episode is the second in a two-part series I've entitled Building Block. By the end of part two here, that name should make sense. In part one, I interviewed Monroe County Council member and candidate for the County Board of Commissioners District 2, Peter Iverson. Listen to that if you haven't yet, before proceeding here. Iverson and today's guest, IU Law Professor and District 3 candidate Jody Madera, are running an aggressive primary campaign against Democratic incumbents Julie Thomas and Penny Githens. Again, since Monroe County is a largely one-party county, the primary more than likely determines the winner in the anticlimactic November election. So, with general election stakes, has come general election nastiness. These races have gotten spicy. Or at least as spicy as an intra-party county government squabble can be. I think that's one pepper on your menu. One longtime Monroe County Democrat calling Iverson a quote-unquote brat. Going into this process, I didn't really have a good handle on the contours of these races, the fault lines inside the Monroe County Democratic Party. As I've conducted these interviews, I've tried to tease out these differences, to get the candidates to state in plain language what problems they have with their opponents. By the end of this interview with Madera, I think I understand. The insurgent candidates have portrayed the incumbents as stubborn obstructionists beholden to NIMBY homeowners and rural interests, while the incumbents have sent out flyers accusing the newcomers of being owned by real estate developers. So, today, I present my second interview with one of the challengers. Jody Madera is the Richard S. Melvin Professor of Law and co-director of the Center for Law, Society, and Culture at the Indiana University Moorer School of Law. According to her official university biography, quote, Professor Madera joined the Indiana Law faculty in 2007. She is an internationally recognized expert in fertility fraud, bioethics, and law and medicine, with a focus on reproductive endocrinology. Her research has received profile in national and international media, including the Netflix documentary Our Father, 2022, to TED, to investigative news programs like 2020 in 2019. Her research interests involve empirical research, the role of emotion in law, the sociology of law, law, medicine, and bioethics, and the Second Amendment. Madera is the author, co-author, or editor of dozens of scholarly articles and now five published books, including Indiana Personal Injury Law Treatise, and The Second Amendment, Gun Rights and Regulation, co-edited with Jacob D. Charles, Joseph Bloker, and Daryl Miller. Both of those released just last year. In our conversation, we'll talk about her life and career inside and outside law, and how those experiences have prepared her to run for elected office. I'll ask about the major areas of focus in her campaign platform: affordable housing, revised development regulations, public safety and a new justice center, and finally, improved city-county collaboration. In the end, I think I finally have a plain language handle on the rift between the incumbents and their challengers. But before we get to this interview, here is some internet panhandling. The thing finally happened. I've been trying to make a full-time go of this project for the past couple months. After my 19-year-old son passed away in January, the day-in, day-out grind of handyman work just didn't seem important anymore. So I doubled down on Who's Left in an effort to shed more light on state and local politics, where Indiana's Republican supermajority and their financial benefactors work tirelessly to ensure more Hoosier parents know the grief of losing a child, whether through lax gun regulation, bullying queer youth, or poisoning our environment, or simply running the next generation out of state with their draconian policies. I've received an outpouring of support. Our subscriber base has grown tremendously, and we're picking up paid subscribers all the time. I've been able to publish more frequently, learn new skills, and expand beyond audio into video podcasting. But the cushion has run out. My wife and I have exhausted our savings, and I've had to don the Carhartt once again, returning to work, repairing, remodeling, and renovating, working on this project whenever I can. I will continue to work to highlight Indiana's bad actors so we can replace them with more empathetic leadership, and also shine the spotlight on the Hoosier activists, organizations, and elected officials who are doing the hard work to build a more just, equitable, and compassionate Indiana for the next generation of Hoosiers. And I'll take on Democrats, too, when they put their donors over their voters, when they talk out of both sides of their mouths, and when they fail to push back against GOP authoritarian extremism with the necessary urgency and tenacity. I will go deep to provide information and analysis you won't get anywhere else in the Hoosier State, but I cannot devote anywhere near the amount of time it takes to do this, at least well, without you. I'm not motivated by the dollars, but everything costs money. Web hosting, equipment, editing software, travel to meet with other activists and organizers, and most of all, just the everyday household expenses that pile up if I'm not earning sufficient income. I need your financial support with a paid subscription over at scottaaronrogers.substack.com. For $5 a month or $50 a year, you can help me push our state in a better direction and help me keep the lights on. And while the best way to help this project is a financial contribution, if you can't afford it at this time, you can still help. Subscribe at the free level over on Substack. Set your favorite podcast player to auto-download new episodes of the show. Rate and review the show on whatever platform you use. Follow me on social media at facebook.com/whosleft. That's H-O-O-S left. I'm also now on Blue Sky at the same handle. Personally, I'm at ScottRoj78, that is S-C-O-T-T-R-O-G 78, on Instagram, Threads, and Twitter. And on Mastodon at ScottRoj78 at Hoosier.social. Want to see my face for some reason? I'm now posting full video episodes of the pod on YouTube and clips on TikTok. The handle on both of those is at Who's Left. Please, subscribe. But most importantly, share our message. Forward the articles to friends, family, and colleagues. Don't just like, but share on social media. Read Who's Left articles to your kids at bedtime. With your investment, a full-time Who's Left could look like new content every day. Full coverage of the 2024 election cycle in Indiana and beyond, and zooming out to see how the networks acting in our state function nationally and even globally. And even though I'm here asking you for money, I do not plan on paywalling any content because, as one of my favorite authors, Sarah Kendzior, who got her master's at IU Bloomington, by the way, says, quote, "It's not cool to paywall political content in a political crisis," end quote. I believe in open access to information, and your support helps make that knowledge freely available to all Hoosiers. But I desperately need your contributions in order to keep bringing you this meaningful content. So please, before this interview, pause right now, go to scottaaronrogers.substack.com and subscribe at the paid level. To those who have contributed already, my sincere thanks. I appreciate every penny. And to everybody, thanks for listening. Now, here's my interview with Jody Madeira. Jody Madeira, welcome to the Who's Left podcast.
Thank you.
So, introduce yourself. Where are you from? How'd you get to be in Bloomington? And why are you running for Monroe County Commissioner?
Well, I am an IU law professor, and I have a law degree from University of Pennsylvania and a PhD as well from University of Pennsylvania. I was a military brat. I was raised in Germany, and for much of my childhood, my dad died when I was 7, so we moved back to Pennsylvania, and that's where I spent the bulk of my childhood. and I was raised by my mom, so a single parent family. So my background didn't exactly match my fellow students at University of Pennsylvania for either PhD or law.
Yeah.
And it certainly didn't match the backgrounds of my fellow postdocs at Harvard. But I also think that, you know, those experiences kind of fed directly into my research, in which I'll talk about a little later, in ways that really gave me more empathy and understanding. So we moved here from Boston in 2007. Indiana University was my first choice because it was the first academic unit that I've ever been part of that was sort of not dysfunctional and felt like a family. And so I was delighted to make that match. I was going to run for District 62 in 2022, but the more I thought about it, the House did not exactly seem like a good fit because I do extensive work in the legislative sessions, just testifying as a legal expert. And sometimes it really seems like you're just screaming into the void. And so I decided at that point to talk to more people in the community and sort of see where my best public service options were in terms of my own interests and my background. And so the more I talked to people, the more it appeared that it was at the county level in the commissioner's seat. I really liked the idea of being part of a board, being part of a group of like-minded decision makers. And so that also seemed to be the position from which I could address many of the problems I saw in the community that people were very unhappy about. And so I also thought that my life experiences have made me sort of uniquely qualified for this office, again, for reasons that I'll get into a little later on.
Well, tell me about that. So you're a law professor, a nationally recognized expert on reproductive rights and bioethics, firearms law, tort liability, and other criminal justice issues. You've not held elected office before. So how has your career and life outside your career, for that matter, prepared you for this new role?
So I think actually losing my father, he was literally in a car accident where he was crushed in between two tractor trailers. And so that was in the newspaper. I saw a picture of it when I was 12. And so, you know, that basically meant that we were participating in a wrongful death lawsuit in Germany. And so I had a firsthand appreciation, I think, for how law affects people's lives and what it means to be tied up in a lawsuit for 10 years that, you know, basically has no financial reward other than settling for basically lawyer's fees. And just the emotional costs of litigation and the importance of alternatives to litigation. And so that was a very, very early lesson, I think, from my childhood. And at that point, I didn't want to be a lawyer, but I think that has played a large part of my life in my life decisions, you know, since then. And so my research has always involved how law affects other people's lives, you know, literally sitting down and talking to people at their kitchen tables, often for hours. And it's about fairly heavy topics, such as the death of their child in a terrorist event like the Oklahoma City bombing, or surviving 9/11, losing people through gun violence, undergoing fertility treatment and having to deal with doctors that were unsympathetic, incompatible, or with this recent research that I've been doing, you know, finding out that your biological father is actually your parents' fertility physician. And so I think those conversations are really what I love about my research, because number one, it automatically makes sure that my research is going to matter. And I'm not analyzing a statute, you know, in an armchair somewhere, absent from its effects on people's lives. And I think that law has intentional and unintentional consequences on lives. And I believe that law also can be changed in a way to make those consequences better, and to really maximize, you know, the good we can get from law. And so oftentimes elected officials don't think about those intentional or unintentional consequences as much as they should. And another point is that we might not know exactly until we go to people who are most affected and ask again how they're experiencing a certain law just through, for example, higher taxes, increased regulation when it comes to something as simple as, I don't know, beer in grocery stores or the availability of birth control. And so I think that focusing on those issues, you know, really is the key point of what law professors should be doing. It's part of the Law and Society movement, you know, something that Indiana University Maurer School of Law is very strong in, and a reason why I came there. And analysis of law independent from society isn't really worth much, I think, or as much as when we consider its human impact. So This matters because a focal point of my teaching and just my purpose in research is emphasizing that law isn't just handed to us on gold tablets. It can be changed, and it should be changed when it's needed to make life easier, more positive, more equitable. And, you know, as to the fact about holding elected office or not, everyone has to start somewhere. And I have been a lobbyist. I've been very, very involved in political advocacy, public advocacy about social issues in particular. We can talk about that. But I think the value of a candidate's experience also depends on what they've accomplished. And although I've gotten a great deal done in the classroom and the research context, I think what's most relevant is my work in public advocacy. So, for example, there was this issue, fertility fraud, and it's when basically doctors in primarily in the 70s and 80s, although we have had some very recent cases as well, use their own sperm samples to inseminate women, without their knowledge or consent. And sometimes they go on to then examine their biological daughters. And it's a very gross example of just the abuse of power that is possible when medical professionals don't follow the laws and don't follow ethics. And so with this issue, together with a group of seven victims, I've passed 11 state laws in 5 years that allow for civil and criminal accountability. And, you know, basically we've put this issue on the map. And so I think that's a small example of what I'll be able to do on the local level as well.
Okay. So your campaign focusing on the local level focuses on like these four main policy priorities, which people can find on your website. And the first, and this is the one everybody's talking about, as I've talked to all of the county commissioners, is to solve our growing housing crisis. So define that, like what you mean by crisis, just so our, you know, our listeners are all on the same page. Not everybody here is from the Bloomington area. And how'd we get here?
Sure, that's a great question. So I define affordable housing to be housing that costs 30% or less of a household's gross income. So that's basically within the budget for low and moderate income residents. Now, we have a housing crisis in Monroe County because we urgently need housing of many different types for diverse groups of residents. And that's a really complex task to solve. It's going to require a lot of collaboration between the city and the county. So let's get a little deeper into it. In September of 2023, basically the median year-to-date price for homes was $300,000. Now, that's compared to approximately $235,000 in Owen County and basically $180,500 in Lawrence County. That's a very, very drastic difference. Meanwhile, the median income for Monroe County for households was around $54,000. And that is a number that holds true from the Census Bureau from about 2017 to 2021. Our rental prices are also the highest in the state. And it's very, very difficult for people of limited incomes to sort of transition to owner-occupied housing or housing that they own. So we need more income-restricted rentals. We need more rental vouchers. We need more low-cost apartments. We need more low-cost single-family homes. We must increase funding for eviction prevention and rental assistance. And also we need additional assistance for eviction expungement, because if you have an eviction on your record, basically that can terminate your hopes of getting housing in the private market, you know, from a private landlord for over a decade. At the same time, we need workforce housing, because employers are and will be coming more to Bloomington. For example, that I-69 corridor in Crane is going to be a huge draw for employers. These employers are going to bring employees. They're going to hire more people here. And we really need affordable townhomes and smaller single-family houses on smaller lots. This actually will reduce long commutes and basically the environmental impacts of those commutes. Because our largest employers in the county report that over half of their employees have to commute in from other counties. And of course, these new employers and the new housing sites must be amply served by public transportation. So in order to accomplish this, I would first do a housing needs assessment with the other commissioners and with the other governmental entities involved. We don't need housing just anywhere. We need it in specific places, and we need it to be of a specific type. And unless we do more to find out what and where we need, that's really, we're just acting blindly. And so we need to do that as a first order of business. Then I think it's important to update the comprehensive plan, which hasn't been done since 2012. And that really should be revised before the county development ordinance. And then we need to revise the county development ordinance to better facilitate development. This involves revising zoning laws, expanding sewers when we're permitted to do so, when the annexation lawsuit allows us to do so, to offer expedited permitting, perhaps for certain uses, fee waivers or subsidies to developers who agree to build low housing and mixed income developments to maximize their private investment. We can use community land trusts and so on. So a lot of this housing, I think, especially in the county, I think would be of two different models. First of all, conservation development. So that avoids sprawl. This is where you build on a third to a half of a property. It also might be the case that the property has wetlands or partial floodplain on it. And this is, again, allows us to maximize the use of those properties. But what missing middle housing offers is it mixes duplexes, triplexes, courtyard apartment buildings, sort of like little small apartment buildings. And it allows those spaces to be incorporated into neighborhoods with other single family homes. So that gives a diversity of housing. It gives sort of this very neat appearance. It allows retail spaces, greater bang for buck with public transportation. And so also that's going to address a lot of the environmental concerns that are present in the county, because although we need to be careful of floodplains and we need to protect wetlands because those have been recently and radically stripped of protections on the federal and state levels, basically, you know, we're also faced with the need to build. And it's not a false choice between, you know, development on the one hand and environmental concerns and protection on the other. We can have both at the same time, and especially, again, planned development. So we're not a rural county. We're a county with a lot of farmland. At the same time, we also need to ensure that rural residents are not marginalized and find ways to re-engage them.
Right.
And so I think currently the CDO, the County Development Ordinance, also makes it very hard to achieve other goals that these folks might have. For example, subdividing land to give it to environmental trusts like Sycamore. And again, I think when we come back to this, you know, sort of summarizing this point, we're needing denser housing for a variety of populations, from income restricted to workforce to families who are looking, you know, just for that first family home. And it's possible to have both more dense development and environmental protections at the same time.
Yeah. Excuse me. What do you say to the, I mean, there's NIMBYs on like both sides of these issues, right? In town, in the neighborhoods, you've got people with single family homes or whatever. They don't want duplexes and triplexes and
right.
small apartments in their neighborhood. And meanwhile, out in the rural areas, you've got people on an acre or more who don't want a subdivision right next door.
Right.
How do you thread that needle?
Well, I think you need to consider neighbor impact. But on the other hand, you know, if they want to control the uses of the lots around them, then they can purchase those lots. And so otherwise, they don't really have anything to say about the farm that comes up behind them. But I think what's reasonable is to come up with attractive developments that are not urban sprawls, they're not tract housing, that many people, you know, feel is very attractive, very reasonable. And so, for example, you know, it's not like townhouses are mixed in with single family homes right next to each other. There's like a townhouse section of the development and a single family home section of the development and a denser, you know, housing section of the development. And so each sort of has its own feel, you know, but there's a sort of like community center that could unite these different areas, for example, that offers coffee places, restaurants, community spaces, commons areas, that kind of
stuff.
Thing.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, again, this is not what I think is currently going on in areas like Bargersville. If you head north to around Greenwood, you'll see very fast developing areas of the community where it's like tract housing, where 60 houses are being worked on at once, and none of them are quite finished. It's all in development, and there's only a few that are occupied, but it's like development leads into development leads into development, and there's no retail spaces or community spaces between them. And I think that's not what we're going to see here.
Car focused, yeah.
Exactly. You know, and just to come back to this issue as well, talking about NIMBY, as one of the NIMBY issues in our community is actually homelessness as well. And that's an issue that affects both the city and the county. And so I think, number one, that needs to be coordinated jointly between the city and the county. But as for policies, I really support providing secure housing first. As a researcher, I really like evidence-based solutions, and this is the evidence-based solution that was adopted by Heading Home. And Heading Home is a coalition that includes the United Way, the Community Foundation of Bloomington and Monroe County, South Central Housing Network, the City of Bloomington, the Monroe County government. And basically, it just aims to eliminate barriers to housing and expedite access. And so, again, this is it's really hard to offer services for substance use and mental health to people that you cannot find. And that's, it's always a risk that the people who need those services most will be, you know, in one location one day and then gone the next. And again, no one's homelessness if they have secure housing. And that's the first priority.
And to people who I think worry about the cost of providing homes for people, it winds up being cheaper in the end, does it not?
Absolutely. There have been studies involving metropolitan areas. And again, Bloomington is a metropolitan area. Monroe County is a metropolitan county, not a rural county. And it's been shown that a very small handful of individuals are not only responsible for, you know, social costs and perhaps most likely to be arrested for, you know, these sort of low-level offenses, but also there are the individuals with chronic health needs that show up at hospitals most often and, of course, cannot pay their bills. And so given secure housing, given recovery services, given mental health services, whatever they need, they're very likely to become great candidates for employment, individuals for some of these individuals, for example, have lost their children. Some of their families have fallen apart. So they become great candidates for reunification. And again, it helps to heal families. It helps to heal individuals. And there's really nothing that is better in terms of stability than having a family, having a support network, having a job, having a place of your own.
Yeah. And if you look at, it's like preventative medicine, right? If you take care of people up front, then you don't have to take care of it later in probably not the best way.
Yeah.
So we talked about a lot of the things I wanted to get to on housing, but you mentioned revising the county development regulations.
Right.
And so your website says, quote, officials are trying to simplify zoning categories for sites and are proposing to rezone approximately 9,300 acres that are currently zoned residential to rural. These new restrictive rezoning regulations would harm county residents, decreasing the supply of available housing, increasing prices to build new homes or purchase existing homes, and stalling economic development. End quote. So what exactly is the difference between the rural and the residential designations, and how does that rezone affect supply?
Sure. So first of all, the County Development Ordinance, or CDO, has actually not had a major update to zoning ordinances, to subdivision control, to zoning maps since 1997. So the CDO, just for those of us who don't know what it is, it regulates housing, business, and other uses across those areas that are unincorporated in Monroe County. In other words, those areas that are outside of Bloomington and also outside of Evansville. And so, yes, underneath the revisions to the County Development Ordinance that have been put in place by the current commissioners, you do see that Monroe County's residential zoned land decreases under these revisions by approximately 9,300 acres. Some of this does include parcels that are in a floodplain, but most of the other changes basically involve rezoning parcels from what's called residential to agricultural / rural residential. And residential basically would mean that you have a home site of 1 acre that's required. And that's largely required because of septic, because the county cannot extend sewers because of the annexation litigation currently. And agricultural rural residential is a bit different. It will allow for housing, but that actually requires a much larger home site that's 2.5 acres instead of 1 acre.
Okay.
And of course, if 1 acre is inequitable and unaffordable for many individuals, and many individuals might not want that much property, they might not want to maintain it. So this hamstrings our ability to provide more affordable housing just when finding this housing is so incredibly challenging. It also places limitations on available land that can increase land prices. And also these restrictions can also add to land and construction costs. And so, for example, if you want to change that, you might have to go for a variance. And so it sets up a process which is meant to be an outlier proceeding, you know, just for when you want to do something that is the exception and not the norm. It sets up that process as a norm, which makes for greater expense and bigger government and longer, you know, times, longer wait times for permits, and also basically increases the workload of the Planning Commission. I do think that also increasing home lot sizes, you know, to 2.5 acres, for example, can also contribute to the sprawl by decreasing how efficiently we can use current land for housing. And again, it's worse for the environment because it spreads the environmental impact of building over a larger area for just one homeowner.
Okay, well, what, for example, what if some people would say, hey, you know, we want to keep this rural feel out here in the county. We don't want the smaller lot size. Why can't we just build denser in town or in the city where it's already developed and not out here next to me, you know?
Yes, and that's a great question. And I think we just don't simply have that property available. So we have about 200 acres of buildable property right now, and that are sort of closer into the city. And I think that's not that much property. So, and again, if somebody wants a rural lot, they can just purchase that rural lot. There's nothing preventing them from doing so. But we don't have to force that lot size on other people. We can allow and facilitate building other options for individuals that are more affordable, and frankly, that might match what they want more.
Okay. And so I hear, you know, we need more housing. We have too many people. We just need to get the supply up to stabilize prices, to bring prices down so there's enough room for more people.
Exactly.
Build.
Yes. Well, not quite build, but I think, you know, plan building. But again, that housing needs assessment is going to be very important. And, you know, we kind of had that build already with the student housing. And those apartment units are being built by, you know, through real estate investment trusts, largely from developers out of state. Whereas the developers that build the neighborhoods here, you know, they're members of our community in some ways. They've been here for, you know, in some cases, I'm sorry, they've been here for like three generations. And so, you know, we can point to neighborhoods that, for example, their father or grandfather built. And, you know, it's sort of just like, you know, printing shops or restaurants that are multi-generational businesses.
I have to ask, I've not seen a campaign finance report from you. So are you receiving any contributions from any of the local real estate developers?
Great question. So campaign finance reports are due on Friday. So we'll be filing in a timely fashion either today or tomorrow. And yes, I am taking contributions from developers. And I am taking contributions from other groups like the Democratic Women's Caucus and Stonewall. Again, so it's really through organizations and, for example, the Builders Association of South Central Indiana. And I don't see a problem with it because I think it's pretty unsophisticated to believe in this day and age that just because an organization contributes to a campaign, whether that organization is related to developers or health or real estate agents, that that's equivalent to buying votes. So whether or not they contribute to a campaign, these organizations belong at the table if they are going to provide important community services. So for example, you know, when we talk about, say we have the housing needs assessment in hand, we're going to bring developers to the table, just like we're going to bring environmental groups to the table. And that's going to happen regardless of who donates or whether they donate or how much they donate. And these are stakeholders in the processes. They're members of the community. Again, often family-owned businesses, just like other community businesses like restaurants or nurseries. And so I don't think organizations are trying to buy change. Rather, they're just voting in ways that do advance their interests because currently we need housing and it's so hard to come by because, again, of these regulations that we have. So just like any other group that's, for example, a Democratic Women's Caucus, their donations and endorsements reflect that their certain candidates align with their values. And so I think it's just, you know, basically very much the same as other social organizations. And I don't get questions about whether the Democratic Women's Caucus is supporting me or Stonewall Democrats or whoever else. That would be the equivalent of saying like, will you prefer women when you make government appointments, or will you prefer LGBTQ individuals for positions? You know, the assumption is that I'm already committed to diversity. The assumption as a candidate is that I'm already committed to developing. And so it doesn't provide any new information. I think basically, you know, to some, these contributions just reflect that these parties finally want a seat at the table that they've been denied for years. For example, Builders Association of South Central Indiana, when they reached out to me, they said they had tried to get the commissioners to come to their events for years, and they never came until they had challengers in campaigns. And so, again, if anybody is still leery after hearing that explanation, there's going to be three county commissioners and a county council. And so it's not just like we are, you know, the kings or queens of the county making decisions unilaterally.
Yeah. I mean, look, you're very upfront with it, and I appreciate that. How can you assure the county there will be no conflict of interest? You know, can you have to recuse yourself from votes or such?
I mean, I think that there are other county commissioner candidates that are taking contributions from developers. There have been city council candidates that have or have taken donations from related organizations such as real estate. And if I had a stake, a financial stake in those businesses, or for example, if I owned a share of a local developer, I would, of course, recuse myself if that developer had a contract, but that's not the case. And I think a campaign contribution, you know, of a few hundred dollars is very different than an actual financial stake that improves, you know, my standing, my financial standing. And so I hope that those individuals who elect me will know that I have an entire system of codes of ethics, if, for example, as a lawyer, that I am also obligated to follow, and I've never had any problem following. And so have already been, you know, working with conflicts of interest for some time. And let me correct that. It's not working with conflicts of interest, but knowledgeable about conflicts of interest rules. I've actually never had a conflict of interest issue. And in fact, it's not likely to come up there. The larger question that many city council members and other members of county and city government have is their roles at Indiana University. And again, we see how rarely, if ever, individuals have to recuse themselves because of a conflict of interest with that entity. And so if that's not a problem because that entity employs us, you know, why would, you know, it basically asking someone to recuse themselves because they got a contribution from a developer in a resolution to build a development would, you know, be akin to asking individuals to recuse themselves from an appointment of an LGBTQ individual because they had gotten endorsed by the Stonewall Democrats. You know, it's individuals and organizations donate to candidates who they think they like, you know, who will advance community interests, their interests, but that is not equivalent, again, to buying votes.
Sure. I do a lot of research about political campaign contributions, who's making them, how much, and I'm leery of real estate developers and builders, because at the state level, real estate developers and builders own the Republican Party, and as such, I think they own the backward state of Indiana politics. So, and I don't want to, you know, cast any aspersions about, this particular individuals in the industry, but my antenna goes up.
Exactly. And I think it should. And I think everybody has, you know, should investigate every candidate, including who finances their campaigns. I think it's also difficult as a first-time candidate to get a war chest. Basically, one of the things that you have when you've been a candidate for years is money left over. And that helps, you know, you might have signs left over. And so, you know, starting from the ground up, you know, I may make decisions this time that I don't have to make in the future. And so, you know, but again, I think if we're building and if developers are interested in building and it's good for the community, you know, that's what's on the ground right now. And so what's good for developers is also good for Bloomington and Monroe County. And again, I think it's not the equivalent of buying votes.
Okay, fair enough. Let's move on to the third item on your campaign checklist there.
Sure.
And that was investing in a new justice center.
Sure.
A little while ago, we talked about the way people's lives interact with the law. Unfortunately, that's kind of where your mind goes, is all you think about is criminal justice and people interacting with the law that way. This thing has been a contentious issue in Bloomington and Monroe County for 15 years now. I'm a lefty. I'm a creature of the left, like the socialist left. I think we spend entirely too much money on policing and incarceration as a society anyway. But on the other hand, like, our current facility is not humane. We have been sued by the ACLU for unsafe conditions.
Right.
I know, you know, prison abolition isn't coming tomorrow and my socialist utopia is, you know, ways off, right? So in the meantime, we need a jail that is safe and humane and connected to other services like mental health, counseling, addiction recovery. How are we going to do all of this? And where? Where has been the big problem? We still don't even have a where. What's the holdup?
Exactly. So a quick remark first to your, you know, wanting to take away the need for so many prisons and so many prison programs and frankly, sort of this law enforcement mentality. I couldn't agree more. I'm a big advocate of restorative justice. I've been on the board of Community Justice and Mediation Center for over a decade, something like 12, 13 years. And I'm a trained mediator. And again, I think because we're actually going in the opposite direction right now with a lot of these policies that are coming down at the state level, the anti-woke movement, because what that will take is a lot of socio-emotional learning, anti-bullying learning, diversity, equity, inclusion training. And those are exactly the same things that Republican leaders are turning their backs on and insisting can't be taught. And so I think that that needs to be a ground up process, you know, basically from birth through early childhood education, through public schooling. And so I think that's going to take an entire different orientation. We're sort of radically going away from that. And that makes me sick.
Generations. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 100%. And instead, we're going into a perspective that sort of reinforces, you know, this law enforcement individual responsibility instead of social conditioning, environmental conditioning perspective that it's horrible, it's awful, it's unscientific, and it's unsustainable. But for the instant purpose for the jail, you're right, for 15 years, we've been under the shadow of this ACLU lawsuit that alleged unconstitutional conditions. And frankly, I'm surprised that Ken Falk hasn't actually done more to sort of re-up the lawsuit. I think he's waiting to see what happens, perhaps from this election, because we know that we're going to get the same with the current commissioners. And so we might actually get something very different if we elect a new candidate or more than one new candidate. So as far as my own stance, we do need a justice center, not just a jail, that needs to be as close as possible to the downtown or in the downtown. That needs to be co-located with the prosecutor and the public defender, as well as the judges. And that needs to have ample room for recovery and mental health services that also can be accessed by other people in the community. And it also has to have these new technologically updated courtrooms, which every other county has seemingly in Indiana, or which many have, you know, which have our justice needs. And the entire facility needs to be served amply and, you know, at basically in some cases 24 hours by public transit options. And so, of course, while this is in the works, we have to maintain the current jail because the current jail is facing severe problems. They're serious, not aesthetic. And those problems likely pose everyday risks to the safety of employees and also to individuals who are incarcerated. I think the new jail facility also, unlike the current jail facility, should be one story. We didn't have an option to do that with the current jail. But for example, right now in the current facility, I've toured it. I've heard stories about the elevator breaking down rather frequently. When that happens, guards have to take individuals who are incarcerated up and down the stairwells. There are no cameras in the stairwells. That is a security risk. It's also a waste of manpower hours when the elevator breaks because they have to walk the meals up and then back down when the inmates have been fed. And so that is not the highest and best use of our time and our dollars. And so a one-story jail facility will be safer and more efficient. The need for co-location is also very important because that does away with the need to transport individuals elsewhere for legal proceedings. And it also would allow us to make sure that services are more comprehensive. So I don't support jails being mental health facilities at all. I don't believe that jails should be places where people receive substance use treatment. In other words, we don't incarcerate to receive treatment. We don't incarcerate to receive mental health treatment. but individuals who are incarcerated for other reasons need to receive basically, for example, cognitive therapy the latest techniques that will help them, not only medication, but also, therapies that they would receive out in the community. They should get those in while they're incarcerated. Currently, individuals can receive prescriptions for Suboxone, but then we have to transport them outside to receive the actual medication. That means that people are going to go into the jail and are going to go into withdrawal because they cannot get that medication in time. If they were able to get the medication there, then that the human suffering would be prevented. In addition, the reason why we need a slightly bigger facility is currently there is one room for any educational programming. And that includes the library. There is a very, very small footprint for that in the current facility, and that needs to be dramatically expanded because, again, individuals who are incarcerated, they're in addition to treatment that they might need, there might be degree programs, there might be language programs, educational programs that they want to take advantage of. And so in addition to the jail facility, and we also need to increase the available options for diversion and basically maintain the funding for our current ones or even expand them. So we currently have a mental health court, a reintegration court, a drug court, and a veterans court. That's very, very, very rare for Indiana counties. Many don't even have a treatment court of any kind or a problem-solving court of any kind. And we need to increase restorative justice programming. We're already pretty good at pretrial release. So we only hold those people who might be a public security risk or a flight risk. Again, at the same time as building the jail, we need to incorporate wraparound programs that will help people transition successfully back into the community, including getting secure housing, including employment. And so I'm really eager to work with Sheriff Marte and his staff on not only finding a site, but also designing programming and, again, getting into some of these alternatives like preventative and post-incarceration wraparound programs.
Yeah, so this sounds like a massive project.
It is, yes.
Big footprint, right? It's got to be one floor. You can't go up, at least the jail part. Where is this going to go? I mean, we don't have this area in town, right?
Right. Well, I hope that we could find an area in town, and perhaps that might change again with greater collaboration between the city and the county that could maybe offer some sites that have not been explored currently. And right now, I think that the Thompson site was the closest that came to those qualifications. Mm-hmm. The current North Park site, currently, if we build there, I mean, this is not property that the county owns. The county owned Thompson for 20 plus years. And personally, I think that we need or we could look at the Thompson site again because, yes, it's going to take more money to move the high voltage line, but that time is also likely to be spent planning. And yes, there's a mound of dirt there. But again, we already own that property, and that's the property up in North Park is going to be substantially expensive. It's also nowhere close to the downtown. And to facilitate transportation, we don't want people to be released basically in a cornfield near a public highway. And it's going to require a lot more resources because it's not a site that's served by public transportation at this point. There's nothing around there. And yes, things will probably eventually be built around that site. But we need to have the ideal location, I think, in place as much as possible when the facility is built.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So there's this theme throughout.
Uh-huh.
And it's this the city and county sort of being at odds. I want to talk about annexation a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's come up. It's been a contentious issue. I'm a county resident.
Mm-hmm.
I live outside city limits, not too far. I'm on city water and sewer. And we knew when we bought the place that it was a candidate for annexation because of that, because we had city services already.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't take a stand on the issue, really. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. But I live on that fault line, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the whole annexation situation is city county bad blood in a nutshell. Do you think I'm onto something there?
I do. And I think it goes exactly back to the issue of collaboration. So as far as my stance on annexation, I don't say I'm pro-annexation. I say I'm pro-strategic growth. I think that cities' growth or annexation, Bloomington has not annexed any property since 2004, but has experienced drastic growth since then. Of course, this issue is now tied up in litigation, and I can talk more about that. You know, that instantly makes people's eyes roll back in their heads usually. My assessment as a law professor is that actually the city is going to win because at the stage of litigation, for them not to win would basically allow the state to invalidate contracts sort of willy-nilly, and you can't do that. That's what we call in the law an absurd result, highly technical term. And the commissioners have actually framed annexation as a fight between a greedy city and, you know, the vulnerable county. And I think the better way of looking at it is look at the connections between the areas to be annexed and the county. Look at the connections between the areas to be annexed and the city. And when we, I feel for the people who are going through this process, because first of all, it's the question is not whether they signed a contract, you know, or whether the prior owners of their homes signed contracts way back when, you know, decades ago. Law should not be used as a cudgel. So you shouldn't just come in and say, you know, by the way, you signed this contract, you have no rights. You know, we're taking you in and you have nothing to say about it. Pay up. And that's not the way you do it. Yeah. And you have conversations about why this is necessary for, and you don't annex everything you can. You do so strategically. You know, what are the areas that really make the most sense? And then you have conversations if there is going to be hardship for someone based on their income or other factors. Then you are going to have to deal with that, and you should deal with that. This is a human, a humane issue. You want this to be handled as smoothly as possible. And so, instead, I think what happened was basically a lot of confused messaging, and people felt like they didn't have any choice, and so they responded the way they did because they felt that, you know, they had to go almost immediately to the state. There was no other alternative because this wasn't started as a conversation. It was started as a cudgel. And I think the messaging around annexation has always been confused. So the commissioners say that they want to extend city sewers to new areas, but then they point to the city and say, you know, this isn't going on and can't go on as long as litigation lasts. But yet, when you look at Julian Penny's campaign materials, they say that they are fighting annexation. So in some ways, they're subsidizing the lawsuit, not maybe financially, but through their support for lending their support for this. And again, you know, this can't be framed as a conversation between growth and no growth. It should be examined as a conversation period about what is strategically needed, what makes the most sense. And another way in which it should not be framed is a conversation between, you know, county residents who are not paying their fair share. And so I would be offended by that as a county resident. I am a county resident. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, if county residents are coming into Bloomington and then leaving and not paying tax rate, not paying taxes, and they are, and the people inside the city of Bloomington, you know, if the city is growing as it has been growing, they're the one paying for services. They're the ones paying the cost of the city growth. That really needs to be shared with the county and, again, the county residents. So it's not that the county residents are not paying their fair share because no one, you know, to date has asked them to. They've never refused, for example. It's just that the city has not been permitted to grow as it should have been permitted. And it's true, you know, past mayors sort of slept on the issue. And that's why, again, mm-hmm. this issue needs to be handled delicately with conversation and dialogue and, you know, not using law as a cudgel.
It sounds like, and this is also true on the national level and everywhere else, but there's a real urban-rural divide.
Yes.
We've got going on in the county here. How do you improve that dynamic? I mean, that's one of the major fault lines in, you know, in national politics right now. And yeah, same here. So
yeah.
How do you improve that?
Well, this actually came up with a conversation I had with the town manager of Ellettsville earlier this week. So I went out to Ellettsville, and again, that's an area that's experiencing great growth, but has usually thought of itself as more rural, and it was headed in the direction where there's more farmland in the county. And I think that, this is what we discussed. We discussed how rural residents feel marginalized, and they don't feel like they're engaged in government. And I think when that happens, it's government's duty to re-engage them. We need to have meetings, for example, not at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays like we do currently with the commissioners. We need to have them in the evenings, or at least a complimentary set of meetings in the evenings where the public can have time to go and express their viewpoints. We, as elected officials, if elected, need to go into those rural areas and make an effort to make ourselves available, more available, because some individuals, they may not have the capacity to go in, whether it's physical, maybe they're during certain times, there might be an issue they want to comment on that they're planting. And so they're basically, their day is occupied, and they could make a 5-minute trip up the road, but it's really hard to make a half an hour trip in, to Bloomington, let alone with traffic. And so we need to make an effort to go out there, and we need to make ourselves more available. We also need to be aware of their concerns. And again, engaging them, will help us increase awareness of those concerns. And, I think that that's a central focus, again, of sort of the collaboration plank in my campaign platform.
Yeah, real quick, and I should know the numbers on this, but what is the population divide, urban versus rural in Monroe
I
County?
actually don't know the most recent numbers, but I think we're up to basically 100,000 urban and a smaller percentage rural. And it's something like, goodness. And it depends. It's a very complex question. I don't mean to say like I don't know the numbers, but it also
Sure.
differs dramatically depending on what is urban and what is rural, right? Because the whole county is not defined as a rural county. For example, for the Center for Rural Engagement purposes, many legal definitions of this county are like you're metropolitan. You are not a rural county. And so, in some cases, the number would be zero. But if we look at, farmland versus urban, then where do we draw those boundaries? But I think, suffice it to say, it's a dramatic difference.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, I think the one of the core things I'm hearing as I've talked to many of the candidates is that there's X amount of residents in Monroe County, the vast more majority of whom live in Bloomington. And so the county commissioners are responsible for representing all of the Monroe County residents, but it seems like the implication is that certain commissioners are really only representing the rural interests, the not in the city limits.
Exactly. I would agree with that.
Okay. I that that's I've been trying sort of as a, it's a one party town. And so painting with a broad brush, oh yeah, all Democrats are the same. So I'm, really going in, I didn't know what the fault lines are. And I'm starting to see it more. And I'm not going to come down one side or another of them, but it's basically like, this is what happens here. All right. Light bulb. All right. Big finish. I will give you the floor for closing statements and tell listeners where they can find out more about your campaign.
So I'm going to use my closing statements to go a little bit back into a platform in my campaign that I haven't gotten a chance to talk much about, and that's collaboration. And again, when I talked to people in the community, they said, we need to move forward. We need to stop finger pointing between the city and the county. We need to get interested and active on these community projects. And some are moving along, like the convention center. Others are still stalled. I'm a person with a demonstrated record of collaboration and policymaking at the national level, at the state level, in the university, and I really want to, and I do have that reputation in the local level as well, again, through my work, such as Community Justice and Mediation Center, or CJAM, and also through my participation in other community organizations, such as the City County Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. So my collaborative reputation is really premised on my coalition building. I bring diverse voices to the table, and that's something I've done in activities from volunteering as a trained mediator to co-chairing the Indiana University Bloomington university-wide tenure committee. It's also based on my skills in soliciting constructive criticism to do my job better. For example, I'm the only candidate who's routinely subject to criticism. Every semester, all of my classes are evaluated by my students. And sometimes if I invite them by sitting faculty members, and I often do. And everything I send out for research is basically criticized. Does it meet, professional norms? How can I make this better? Did I cite who I needed to cite? Do I know my information? And this does not make me bitter. It makes me a richer person. It makes me a better professor. It makes me a better public servant. And I think, again, that same ethic is something I would bring to the chair, to the board of commissioners if I was elected. To me, collaboration means communication. And this is basically not something that my competitors have, the commissioners. And you sort of run against all three commissioners at once, even the ones who aren't elected, because they act as a body. So the commissioners frequently have breakdowns in communication. This is a phrase that my opponent Penny recently used to describe her relationship with Sheriff Marte, as the Herald Times highlighted in late March. Collaboration means respect for other county officers and offices as co-equal branches of government. And again, the commissioners have consistently had difficulties respecting these other branches as co-equal. Collaboration means incorporating diverse voices and being willing to hear and act on constructive criticism. But the commissioners have shown the community that they're really unwilling to hear what others have to say. For example, they disbanded the Community Justice Response Committee, which had judges and people of color and had their lived experiences and professional expertise to offer. And they disbanded that because their recommendations challenged current commissioner policies. And the commissioner said, we want feedback, not challenges. But the very best feedback does challenge, because challenge brings diversity and development. Collaboration also means transparency, and collaboration means forward momentum. And here again, we think of the convention center. And so state lawmakers had to get involved. They asked why the convention center expansion wasn't progressing. They asked where the money had been spent. And this really even risked the project because, the state legislature is the one that gave us permission in 2017 to impose that 1% food and beverage tax. And it can take that permission away. And so, again, if we're on our game, then the state does not need to be involved. So I am the respectful, collaborative, coalition-building, forward-looking candidate for District 3. I want to create a community where my kids, where our kids can continue to live, find jobs, and thrive. And I would direct people to my website, jodyformmonroecounty.com.
Very good. Jody Madera, thank you for joining the Who's Left podcast.
Thank you very much.
Once again, that was Democratic candidate for Monroe County Commissioner Jody Madera. For all the nastiness in this campaign, I hadn't been able to figure out the exact reason until this interview. But the light bulb finally went off there at the end. What I understand now is that the challengers, Iverson and Madera, as well as former longtime Bloomington City Councilman Steve Volan, are basically accusing incumbents Thomas and Githens of governing on behalf of county residents living outside city limits to the exclusion of Bloomington residents, who are also their constituents. Monroe County has a population of approximately 140,000 people, with about 85,000, that's 60%, living inside the city. The primary complaint seems to be that the incumbents have obstructed necessary projects in the county. Volan saying the commissioners, quote, dithered for years, end quote, on the convention center and the jail, and wasted time, quote unquote, bickering with City Hall. Furthermore, the challengers are implying the incumbents are to blame for the lack of new housing development precisely because they have aggressively fought annexation, and this has led the city to stop extending sewer service while litigation plays out. And while the jail, the convention center, and annexation have been years-long issues, it is housing and development that have really come to the fore this election cycle. And I can't help but feel like that may be driven by the big spenders in these races. Now here, I'll cite some statistics from the impeccable Dave Askins of B Square, who has almost single-handedly filled the gap in local government coverage as Gannett has gutted Bloomington's daily newspaper, the Herald Times. While Givens technically leads the quintet in fundraising with just over $20,000, a significant portion of that comes in the form of a $5,000 loan to the campaign from herself, another $2,700 left over from 2022's unsuccessful run for State House District 62, and a couple of $1,000 donations from relatives. Meanwhile, her opponent Madeira's $17,000-plus haul includes a $5,000 in-kind contribution from brand design firm Myers Croxton Group, and here's the one I've keyed in on, $3,250 between developers Authentic Homes and Keystone Construction. In District 2, Iverson more than doubles Thomas's fundraising mark, including a whopping $10,000-plus split among three different builders, Winninger Construction, the aforementioned Authentic Homes, and Dishman Construction. I first wondered about the funding for the two outsider candidates when I began to notice, one, the sheer number of yard signs for Iverson and Madeira, two, the fact that their signs always seem to appear together, and three, I've seen their signage sharing space in multiple locations with Republican gubernatorial candidate Brad Chambers, himself a multimillionaire real estate developer. Iverson's 2023 financial report noted a $5,500-plus contribution from Winninger, and I asked him about that in the last episode. And you just heard me ask Madeira about funding from developers here a few minutes ago. Those interviews took place on April 8th and 18th, respectively. Askin's numbers come from financial disclosure statements submitted April 19th, so we didn't know the full extent of real estate developer involvement until after the interviews were conducted. Both candidates insist they can remain impartial if a proposed development from one of their donors comes before the Board of Commissioners. Look, I get it. Political campaigns need money. It is perfectly legal and understandable for local businesses of any type to contribute to candidates they feel will best represent their interests. Bloomington and Monroe County do need more housing. I have no reason to doubt anyone's honesty or integrity, and please do not infer that I am doing such by pointing out these numbers. But, like I told Jody, when I see money in politics, my antennas go up. It's kind of what I do. I am not here to endorse one candidate or block of candidates over another in this primary, only to provide information. Consistent with that aim, I've got an interview with incumbent District 3 Commissioner Penny Githens coming in the next few days, and am still efforting Volan at the time of this recording. I'm hoping to talk with everybody before Election Day, May 7th. Thank you for listening. Follow me on Facebook, Blue Sky, YouTube, and TikTok at Who's Left, and on most other social media sites at ScottRodge78. If you want to reach me, send me a DM on the socials or email me at ScottRodge78@gmail.com. My guest today, Jody Madeira, can be found online at JodyForMonroeCounty.com. That's Jody, J-O-D-Y, 4 F-O-R, spelled out, MonroeCounty.com. If you haven't yet, when you're finished here, please go to scottaaronrogers.substack.com and subscribe at the paid level. Help me keep this project going. Until next time, this has been the Who's Left Podcast. I'm Scott Aaron Rogers. Love each other, Indiana.